As a longtime complementary medicine practitioner, I know how important it is to ensure that the supplements I prescribe are genuine, professional-grade, and effective. That's why I use Fullscript as my online dispensary, so I can send my patients as well as Intelligent Medicine listeners the exact products they need. If you're a healthcare provider, do what I did and sign up for a free Fullscript account. Just go to fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. It's the easiest way for you to prescribe the exact supplement protocols your patients need. Fullscript is the most trusted source for professional-grade supplements. Sign up for a free Fullscript account at fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. That's fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we're answering your questions. Your questions can be sent to us via radioprogram@AOL.com. That's the email address for questions related to health, nutrition. You've got a medical question that you want to pose and get an answer from an intelligent medicine perspective. Radioprogram@AOL.com. With me, Layla Mudin. She's a registered dietitian, has a master's degree in the field of nutrition. We work together at our office in Manhattan. And Layla brings you as well intelligent medicine podcasts that come out usually on Friday, TGIF. It's time for Layla.
Yep. Right?
Okay.
Yep. Time for me to weigh in. Yep.
Yes, Layla weighs in. Get it? Get it? Okay. She's a nutritionist. Get it? Okay.
Ba-da-ba-ba.
Yep. All right. Clever. All right. Yeah. So what's our next question, please?
We've got an email from Bob. Bob is a subscriber to the Intelligent Medicine newsletter, loves the articles, loved the article on "Is Your Coumadin Killing You?" that you wrote, Dr. Hoffman.
Yep.
He's asking, is there something addressing the removal of arterial plaque or any other action other than getting a stent, mm-hmm. an angioplasty?
Yeah. Well, you know, the article, just to remind people, and you can find it at drhoffman.com. You know, if you subscribe to the newsletter, you get first dibs at the articles. They come out in the middle of the week, and you'll have them directly in your inbox. But, you know, say you're not subscribing or you miss one, you can go to drhoffman.com and check out our news feed. The article basically was saying that if you take Coumadin is a vitamin K antagonist. That's how it works within the blood. And as a result, you may have very low levels of vitamin K, and vitamin K is protective against both atherosclerosis and osteoporosis through its action on calcium metabolism. In other words, it sends calcium to the right places and keeps away from the wrong places.
Yeah.
I mean, in an overly simplified way.
Mm-hmm.
So the
What's interesting, Dr. Hoffman, is that recently, you know, we've been prescribing vitamin K. The dosage comes in micrograms, typically at 180 micrograms a day. But lately, with the scientific research, it's revealing that we need to go as high as 320.
Yes. Yes.
And that's something we've already started doing.
That's hot off the presses. That's from the horse's mouth, Dr. Schurgers, who did a lot of the initial vitamin K research from the Netherlands. He's an expert on atherosclerosis. Now is exploring doses as high as 320 for protecting against atherosclerosis. And he hasn't completed the study, but it's underway, looking at that intervention in folks who have atherosclerotic plaque. Now, so that right there is a potential method of slowing the progression of calcification. Now, the problem with calcium scoring is that it can establish the presence of risk for atherosclerosis. In other words, a person has a high score, they're at risk for cardiovascular disease. But it's not that good for monitoring. And the reason is that it tends to keep going up no matter what you do. You know, you could be on the best diet, you could be exercising, and
you could be meditating.
Yeah, doing all the right stuff. However, so that points to an inherent flaw of the calcium scoring, which is that it just measures calcium. It doesn't distinguish between the good calcium and the bad calcium. And it's thought that when you have arterial injury or inflammation, that calcium acts as kind of a spackle. And, you know, all our home handy men and women know that spackle's a good thing because it keeps the walls from falling down, you know, and deteriorating. So you want to put some spackle on the cracks before the cracks get worse. And so the mere presence of calcium, and even if it goes up, doesn't mean that you're worse off. You might actually have qualitatively less inflammatory plaque, which is at risk of breaking off and or creating a focus for a blood clot. So you can't really say, well, I don't know of any technique that completely reverses plaque. Even chelation therapy, I noticed, did not, sort of clean out the plaque. I mean, that would be the.
Is it not as promising as we once hoped? I mean, is that really the result?
It's very promising for determining who we should go full court press on for reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease as a screening test. So, in other words, this is a very common scenario, as you know, in the office. We get people come in and they say, you know, I have high cholesterol. I've been told by my doctor that I need to go on a statin. And I go, well, I don't completely put that out of question, say, oh, you know, statins are bad. You know, drugs are bad. That's a big pharmaceutical industry conspiracy. I mean, there's a place for them in people who are at high risk. And so we screen them.
Yes.
And lo and behold, sometimes we find people who have very high cholesterol, sometimes over 300, they have zero plaque. We give them the good news. Or alternatively, we'll find people who, you know, they don't have such terrible cholesterol, but to our surprise, they may have a lot of plaque. We just saw such a patient yesterday who's just a superb specimen. She's over 70, but she's like a champion bodybuilder and has eaten very well. But for some reason, she's accumulated a lot of plaque. However, I don't think she's at particularly high risk for cardiovascular disease because of her excellent cardiovascular conditioning. So the point being is that it's a good screening test, but it's not that great a monitoring test. Where we might use it for monitoring is we might say, okay, great, you know, at 50, we found you had zero plaque, but maybe checking back in when you're 60 or 65 and make sure if you're still, how you doing. And sometimes we'll see an uptick and sometimes not.
What about the chiolic aged garlic?
Absolutely.
And the promise
that
of
has been shown.
Either stopping the progression of or possibly even reversing, which I'm very excited about.
Well, absolutely. And that's been studied. That's not just speculation. That was actually studied by Dr. Budoff at UCLA, who's an expert on calcium scoring. And he was persuaded by the Wakanaga folks to do a study of people on statins, either with or without the chiolic. So in other words, it wasn't just chiolic alone. It was an add-on to the statins. And what they found is that the statins somewhat slowed the progression. Maybe the progression was, I don't know, 15 or 18%. But when you added on the chiolic at a dosage of 2 twice daily, I think the dosage is 12. Is it 1,200 or 2,400? I'm not sure. I think it's 2,400.
I think
4
it's
pills 24. A day. Yeah, 4 600 milligram pills.
Yeah, 24.
Yeah, there was an even greater prevention of plaque. It still progressed, but not at such a great rate.
Yeah.
So, I mean, other things, obviously, olive leaf extract and resveratrol and perhaps curcumin, fish oil, you know, those are all part of the panoply of things we might use. Bergamot, of course, which lowers cholesterol, but it also has anti-inflammatory properties.
Right, right. And the thing to do more than anything is prevention. But, you know, we're only born with pristine arteries. After the age of 2, anything can pretty much happen. But again, coming back to that spackle, that calcium or that cholesterol, the question to ask is, why is there a crack in my wall? Why is there a crack in my coronary artery? And would you blame the painter who brought over the spackle to fix your, would you blame the spackle for the crack in your wall? Of course not. And the same way, we should not blame the cholesterol or for that calcification occurring. We need to back up and ask, why did the crack happen?
And that's really the contention of our LDL skeptic who we recently had in the program, a doctor who pointed out, you know, quite accurately that sometimes high LDL is the body's response to stress or inflammation, and that LDL is actually a shuttle. It's not a molecule. It's a structure. It's a particle that actually may transport cholesterol, not just to the artery, but away from the artery. Yeah.
So, it's also considered an antioxidant, but you wouldn't hear that from a cardiologist.
No. And here's the latest. I mean, I think you heard the news is that, this week, it was discovered, and I put that in air quotes, discovered, you know, the Dr. Evil air quotes, that, lo and behold, that high cholesterol in the old is protective against neurological decline. So that you, you know, if you're like past 80 or 85 and you haven't had cardiovascular disease, and your cholesterol is like 300,
you're going to live longest.
Good for you. You're going to maintain your brain function. High cholesterol is correlated with brain protection because, of course, the brain is loaded with cholesterol. And then the other study that I found interesting was that in patients with MS, well, they didn't do this with patients. They fed mice with an animal model of MS. They fed them cholesterol. They actually added cholesterol to their feed. And it protected their brains from myelin deterioration, which is the mechanism by which MS damages the nerves.
Myelin is the fatty sheath that surrounds the nerve cells, the neurons.
Precisely.
And MS is the disintegration of all of that via the immune system. But yeah, I think 10 years from now, Dr. Hoffman, what do you think? You think cholesterol will be such a bad guy anymore?
I think it only depends on the pharmaceutical industry if they move on to other more profitable drugs. You know, seriously, because there are such profound economic incentives for telling that story. And, you know, talk about messaging. You know, if you, you know, when you were a kid and you ask your parents about cholesterol, and they may have had a glimmer of understanding of that, but they weren't too particularly worried about it. I think even when I started medical practice, it was a concern if your cholesterol was above, I don't know, 250 or something. And now we've so thoroughly indoctrinated the populace into being cholesterol phobic and fat phobic that, it's a really a terrific job of messaging. And these are among the best selling drugs, you know, perhaps rivaled by acid blocking drugs in the world. And, you know, until they come up with maybe, you know, more effective but similarly profitable drugs, these won't fall by the wayside. And in fact, they're doubling down on this because they now have come up with medications that are for people who take the maximum dose of, say, Lipitor, 80 milligrams of Lipitor, and their cholesterol is not adequately lowered. They want them to take injections of something called Repatha, which will lower the cholesterol into the single digits. And
that's frightening.
And you see advertisements for that on TV. So, you know, what's it going to do to people's brains? Well, you know, no question there may be some benefit to people who are at high risk of heart attacks, you know, perhaps people who've had stents or bypass, maybe they really need aggressive cholesterol lowering, but at what cost? We won't know until 5 or 10 or 20 years hence. And that's a concern. Yeah.
It is, yeah.
Just, you know, just like all the kids on ADD medications, you know, what's it going to do to their brains when they're 40, 50, 60, 70? Well, you know, experiment in progress, and they're the guinea pigs. All right, this is a good point at which to pause because we allow our sponsors to share a message with you. So listen up. Here goes. As a longtime complementary medicine practitioner, I know how important it is to ensure that the supplements I prescribe are genuine, professional-grade, and effective. That's why I use FullScript as my online dispensary so I can send my patients, as well as Intelligent Medicine listeners, the exact products they need. If you're a healthcare provider, do what I did and sign up for a free FullScript account. Just go to fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. It's the easiest way for you to prescribe the exact supplement protocols your patients need. FullScript stocks the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere. The best part, FullScript sends out refill reminders, so it's totally effortless for your patients to stay on track with their supplement protocols. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA compliant, and they offer world-class support. Improve patient outcomes, rest easier knowing your patients are getting exactly what you prescribed them. FullScript is the most trusted source for professional-grade supplements. Sign up for a free FullScript account at fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. That's fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a free resource to you. So please get out there and investigate them and support them. All right, now let's get back to our discussion. And Layla, what's next?
Oh, we've got an email from Carol. Would Dr. Hoffman care to comment on the recent push to have desirable A1C levels higher than previously recommended for type 2 diabetes? This was actually posted on Medscape. Mm-hmm. So basically, yeah, I pulled this. This was updated.
Did you pull the article? Yeah, what do they say? What's the rationale for that?
Yeah. The American College of Physicians, the ACP, recommends a target hemoglobin A1C of 7% to 8% for most non-pregnant adults with type 2 diabetes. And here's their rationale. ACP's analysis of the evidence behind existing guidelines found that the treatment with drugs to targets of 7% A1C or less, compared with targets of about 8%, did not reduce deaths or macrovascular complications mm-hmm. like heart attack mm-hmm. or stroke, mm-hmm. but did result in substantial harms.
So
blood sugar, medication burden, all of that.
Yeah, okay, so this is actually very interesting because what they're in a sense saying is that the drugs that lower the cholesterol, I'm sorry, that, well, we could say that for cholesterol too, but we could, in this case, sugar, the drugs that lower the sugar don't make you live longer or protect you from disease. They fix the number, but they don't create a net benefit. And so I would invoke the saying, it's not how low you go, it's how you get there. And if you get there with drugs that mm-hmm. radically lower your blood sugar artificially mm-hmm. without changing the fundamentals, you know, your body fat, your diet, your exercise, your antioxidant levels, essential fatty acids, you name it, you won't get as good a result as if you lower the hemoglobin A1C through lifestyle measures. However, I, from my standpoint, I'm going to issue an official statement from the, Dr. Ronald Academy of Medicine that, it is desirable to lower your hemoglobin A1C to the lowest possible level.
Yes.
Through diet. And there is no limit. Virtually.
We're talking to less
get
than
it down
5.
To 5.5, 5.2, get it down to 5.1,
Mm-hmm.
Which we have seen, which we've actually seen when people really take us seriously and follow our suggestions to a T, right? Because there is no harm to that. And in fact, you know, Dr. Perlmutter has pointed out in several of his lectures that even a hemoglobin A1C that is a little borderline, like 5.7, 5.8, for each 0.1 point increase, you see about a 10% increase in the risk of cognitive decline. So here are these folks ticking along. They've got type 2 diabetes, and they go to the doctor, and their hemoglobin A1C is 6.8, 7.0. And they say, that's fine. That's good enough. You know, keep taking your medication. Mm-hmm. They're still experiencing the harmful effects on their heart, their arteries, their brain, their kidneys. Mm-hmm.
To paint a picture of what excessively high blood sugar like that does, it basically rusts you.
Yeah.
That's really what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, the advanced glycation end products, all of that. And coming back to when we were just talking about coronary artery disease and how to reverse the plaque, the question about what caused that crack in my living room, on my living room wall, or what caused that crack in my artery? Is that high A1C?
Right.
It's the high blood sugars. That's what's causing the plaque, because that high A1C is also causing the LDL, the spackle, to oxidize.
Yep.
And become a bigger problem.
And this is, and I think medical professionals know this, but I think the public needs to be reminded of this, is on the one hand, you can measure glucose, you can measure your sugar, and people finger stick, they measure their sugar. But when you measure hemoglobin A1C, what you're actually doing is you're looking at the proteins, the hemoglobin, mm-hmm. in your red blood cells and the effect of high blood sugar on that protein. And what hemoglobin A1C is, it's a sign of damage to the protein in your red blood cell. Now, why do we look at the red blood cell? Because it's easily extractable from the body. We can just pull it out with a needle and we can, you know, test it. I mean, we could equally test your brain tissue, your heart tissue, your kidney tissue, and we'll see that it is glycosylated. It's got, you know, sugar tags on it that cause the protein to malfunction. That's what hemoglobin A1C is. And so if we let hemoglobin A1C go up, you know, I agree. We don't want to over-medicate people because the medicines have harmful effects, but we do want to get that hemoglobin A1C as low as possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's a great question.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And Carol, thank you for emailing us.
Okay. Is there such a thing as a short question to wrap up
with? I've got a short one.
Good.
I think that this is a short one. This comes from, this is actually a follow-up question from Carol. I recently started drinking bottled kombucha. The brand I chose is low in sugar, about 25 calories a serving. It's got some ginger in it. I wanted your opinion on whether it's a good idea. Does it have any health benefits? And I always enjoy the podcasts. Thank you. Kombucha's okay.
Yeah. I mean, I used to do kombucha tea when I was in my macrobiotic phase.
Ooh,
You know, what's your take on it? It was very popular for a while. Is it truly a fermented food? Does it give you pre or probiotics?
It's supposed to provide some probiotics. It is fermented. I caution people because it does have small amounts of alcohol, maybe 1%, maybe 2%, which may be the equivalent of what? What are those brands of, you know, hard iced teas and lemonades and that kind of a thing? So be careful that. Be careful that. And beware of anything that is, if it's overly sweet. Because you have to wonder if the fermentation was completed. Yeah.
You know what it says? When we do these podcasts in tandem, by the way, it's good because when you talk, I can look up and vice versa. It says here that kombucha is high in glucuric acid. That's like calcium D-glucarate, which is beneficial to the liver and aids its natural detoxification and especially detoxification of excess hormones. So maybe there's a benefit there.
There we go.
It supports healthy gut bacteria, blah, 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 blah. Can you get drunk on kombucha is another theme here.
Well, if you drink a gallon of it, you might, or half a gallon of it.
It says here it's a bad way to get drunk because it would be like trying to drink a vinegar bottle after bottle. Because you'd have to drink 8 bottles of kombucha just to get the buzz of one beer. So,
<you know. laughs> So go have a beer instead.
And here's another. You know, I'm just Googling it, and it says, "Can kombucha give you a yeast infection?" Well,
all right.
No,
that's a good question.
Yeah.
No. I was going to say, we have to be careful with probiotic foods like that.
Yeah.
Because if you already have candida or yeast infection, adding more fermented foods, they're just kind of joining the candida or the yeast party.
SIBO, if SIBO is happening, you don't want to add too many more you know, bacteria. So the other thing I would suggest is that what about people on a low histamine diet? We saw a guy yesterday. We wanted to put him on a low histamine diet. Would we have him consume kombucha tea?
No, I would not because you have to be very careful of fermented pickled foods on a low histamine diet.
Okay, got it.
These foods that have been preserved, fermented, cured, aged, any of those are out on a low histamine diet.
Because
so.
They generate histamine or they have allergenic potential.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Great. All right. Well, so there's a good question. Yeah. And so, you know, kombucha tea, I mean, just like with everything, I mean, sometimes beneficial, but there may be some contraindications.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that wraps it up for today's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, our weekly Q&A with Layla. Thank you, Layla, for joining us, and happy spring. And those of you in the Northeast, by the time you hear this podcast, hopefully you'll be dug out and walking around in shorts and shirt sleeves.
Right. For now, the snow is still going sideways.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody.
Enjoy it. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients regularly, along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.